Welcome to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact they're having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wicklund. Okay, so before we get started, if you are loving this podcast, please be sure to like, subscribe, leave us a five-star review, and share this episode. So today we're going to be talking about taking a look at the growing normalization despite stalled legalization or legislation, sorry. And I have to say, before we get started, we've been doing this podcast for a couple of years, and I'm always blown away at the experts and leaders in this industry that are willing to give us their time so graciously and sit down with us. And, you know, today is no different. So I could probably just on the brief, you know, internet stalking I've done, I could probably fill this entire show with all of your accolades and everything that you've been profiled. And I mean, you're absolutely everywhere, but I will tell you that I thought this is very interesting that you are best known for being the world's first full-time marijuana rights editor for a major American newspaper. So it's amazing. But today he is founder and CEO of Grasslands PR and marketing agency. Please welcome Ricardo Baca.
Thank you, Heather. It's great to be here with you all.
We're thrilled. And as always, I'm pleased to welcome back our leader of our amazing research team, Mr. John Caggia.
Delighted to be back. Thank you.
So Ricardo, it's so interesting. So I know you went to school for journalism and you were a TV critic. And then it seems like you went to the Underground Music Festival or Music Showcase. Tell us about how you kind of got into all that. That's amazing.
You know, I was always a journalist. So I did go to journalism school, was a arts reporter, television critic, pop music critic, entertainment editor. I had a great run, but all throughout that time too, I always found that I had this strange, at least strange for a journalist, entrepreneurial bent. And so I was always starting new projects, new blogs, new microsites, and new festivals. And so, yeah, I founded the Underground Music Showcase here in Denver. It's entering its 21st year, coming up at the last weekend of July. It's always the best time to be in Colorado, 200 plus bands all over the Baker neighborhood, where actually Grasslands is also located. So yeah, it was a wild ride up until the marijuana editor job came along in 2013.
That's amazing. You must be a legend. You're still in Denver, so that's great. So what made you kind of go into marijuana? Like, what made you jump at that?
Well, yeah, I was approached by the editor-in-chief actually back in 2013 to cover the implementation of the market. And so the editor of the Post at the time, his name was Greg Moore, very thoughtful journalist, Pulitzer judge, formerly of the Boston Globe. And he just recognized the double standard that existed in traditional media at the time. Because of course, the only time journalists were writing about cannabis was when something was going wrong. And oftentimes a lot of mainstream journalists are responsible for repeating a lot of the prohibitionist propaganda coming from the federal government over the last eight decades. And so he recognized there was this double standard because he's like, hey, at the Denver Post, we have a beer blog and we talk about it in news sense, but also from a cultural and lifestyle reporting sense. And we should do the same exact thing for cannabis. And so he charged me to do that. And so I created a standalone news vertical called The Cannabist. We did a lot of groundbreaking reporting. We treated this like the legitimate industry it was and is. We did investigative reporting, holding industry and regulators accountable. And we also had a lot of fun. I hired three or four pot critics. I hired a cookbook author to come in and write recipes about cooking with cannabis, columnists talking about parenting while being a cannabis consumer in a really complicated era. So that was The Cannabist. It was a product of the Denver Post, and I was lucky enough to lead that ship for 3.5 years. So it was kind of the first time a major metropolitan media outlet did that. And so it got a certain amount of attention back in 2013, 14, 15.
Amazing. So Grasslands, you call it a journalism-minded agency. Talk to me about that. What does that mean?
Well, you will only ever find one journalism-minded agency in the world, and that is us. This is really a construct I was developing in my last few years of journalism, just recognizing that PR, was pretty broken. A lot of the PR that I've seen throughout 24 years of journalism, I just found it really lazy and uninspiring. And I just wondered, can this be done differently? And so I started talking to some friends who were hiring marketing agencies themselves. And I found that they shared my sentiment that it was uninspired and they were not getting the work they needed out of these marketing professionals. And so with that knowledge, I was truly inspired to head out on my own and create a different kind of agency because, of course, I could have started a PR marketing agency. I could have joined a marketing agency. But really, I wanted to start from scratch and start something that was founded in the tenets of journalism. So we're talking not only, being ethical and being cognizant, but also being very content forward, approaching deadlines from the perspective that these things are not to be missed. And also maybe making sure that like all communications channels are always open, developing those relationships constantly with your clients, but also with the media, and really taking into consideration the many constraints and challenges the modern media is under in 2022 America. So we've really approached this from a different perspective and found some success with it too.
Amazing. John, any questions you have? I know you know Ricardo, so.
Well, just a point of feedback. You know, I remember when the cannabis spooled up. So I've started looking at the cannabis industry about 2011. At that point, it wasn't from a professional context, just as a data junkie that saw something really important happening in terms of a social movement that looked like it'd be transformational in American society. And so, but at the time, it was just such a hodgepodge. You didn't know there was very little good information out there. And you know, a lot of lazy writing, a lot of stereotypes and double entendres, the puns about pot smokers as they've been stereotyped and characterized. And so when the cannabis emerged in 2013, that was actually one of the first times I looked at this and said, all right, so if there's room for professional journalism here, there's room for the kind of work that we do. And so a shout out to Ricardo, because that was a really affirmative moment as we began kind of exploring how we might get into the industry, that, you know, where great ones lead, others follow. And I think Ricardo has been case exemplar for that, for this industry.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that. And, you know, it really, I pay tribute to my former colleagues at the Post, who really just helped us bolster that site with legitimate journalism. And of course, we need the activist journalism that has always been there, right? You know, the High Times of the World, they've been around for 45 years. And at the same time, they are not traditional journalists, and they're not looking to hold anybody accountable, especially the industry. And so that is important to have those traditionally trained capital J journalists out there doing that digging and making sure that we're protecting everybody from a perspective of public health, good governance, and beyond.
Yep. Amazing. Well, moving on, New York Times reported cannabis events come out of hiding in New York City. So while legalized sales are still on the horizon, some businesses are trying to connect with the public. So conferences with vendors and expos give individuals the opportunity to see kind of what the buzz is about. So Ricardo, what kind of role do you think these operators play in normalizing cannabis for the broader population?
Oh, you know, it's huge. And frankly, we need to see a lot more of it. And it doesn't appear to be like there's a lot of room for this within most state and provincial regulatory frameworks. But in order to truly normalize cannabis, we do need to bring it out of that closet. And this has been a glaring omission in terms of how we've been approaching this conversation about normalization, primarily because of that lingering stigma. And when you talk to people, you're like, how many bars are open in your town or in your city? And it's like so many that we can't even count. And it's like, okay, cool. So let's do the next logical step and give cannabis consumers a place to socially consume and communally get together and be together around this, which happens to be our substance of choice.
Right. And it's like kind of enough with the pearl clutching. It's not so bad. John, what's your take on that?
So, there's so much both potential opportunity and impact that we think that the advent of social cannabis spaces, social cannabis consumption spaces are going to have in American society. So one is just from the consumer's experience standpoint. We know from our consumer data that the majority of consumers still are more likely to consume on their own than with others. And that's largely a function of cannabis being illicit. So even those who consume socially tend to consume socially in very narrow contexts. You've got your small group of friends that you'll be consuming with, but they just haven't been fora, at least up until very recently with the larger type festivals, where you can go and be part of a community of people who are all kind of brought together by cannabis. And I think one of the things that's interesting about the role that we think that social lounges will play, one is that they have a hyper-local nature. So people are going to be coming in from their neighborhoods to be in these environments. Two, when we look at the cross-section of who consumes cannabis, we think it's going to attract a really interesting kind of diversity and cross-section of people that in most cases probably wouldn't end up being in the same room in many other instances. I think there's an idea of creating community in a way that that is unique to cannabis, because you have such a broad representation of people whose lives may not cross in any other context, but for their shared passion for cannabis. And then third is this catalytic effect of the transition from a life lived in the shadows to being open and willing to be a consumer and be observed consuming in public. And we think that unshrouding of the cannabis consumer's experience is going to be really transformational for a lot of consumers who, one, have thought that, you know, their experience was really unique and isolated, and they thought that they were very special in terms of being, you know, having a very particular type of experience, and them coming out and realizing, hey, there's a lot of other people who look like me and consume like me, even though they may not look like me, or who approach cannabis the same way I do. I think that's going to be really important in accelerating the normalization of cannabis, in quickening the confidence that cannabis consumers have to be themselves out in public, and to dissolve this latent stigma and presumption about who the cannabis consumer is. I think the communities you're going to see start forming in these lounges, particularly the ones that are well done and do a good job of attracting members of the broader community writ large, I think it's really going to challenge some of these entrenched stereotypes around who the cannabis consumer is, and do it on Main Street. So to challenge the broader American conversation around what this community looks like and what binds them. So we think it's going to be catalytic and really excited to see what happens as these types of spaces start to gather momentum.
Yeah.
And just to kind of piggyback, if you don't mind, Heather, John, I think it will be very illuminating to communicate to us who these consumers are, but also how they operate in these spaces, how they exist in these spaces, because I think we can't help but be just generally ignorant about what this is going to look like. I mean, sure, we know what the coffee houses look like in Amsterdam, and I've been fortunate enough to be in a lot of consumption lounges in San Francisco, Toronto, and beyond. But you know, I think we just, when we think about these, especially from a prudish prohibitionist perspective, we just kind of envision. I've heard regulators talk about how there's just going to be plumes of smoke barreling out the door when you open it, and that's just not going to be the case, because it's when you walk into a bar, unless it's like 1:30 a.m. on a Friday night, it's not necessarily like everybody's just ripped. You know, a good example is Barbary Coast in San Francisco. That's a really well-done consumption lounge. My first time there, I was kind of blown away because, yeah, a couple people were smoking. A couple people were hitting their vape pens. Somebody had rented a Puffco Peak, and another table had rented a Volcano. And there, multiple people there just doing work, writing in journals, writing on their laptops, alone, very solitary. There was a couple on their first date, and it's so important to recognize that this is going to very much resemble a bar, but even a coffee shop, because of course, cannabis is such a vastly different substance than alcohol. So I think it's important to kind of reset what the cannabis consumer looks like too, and how they behave in these kinds of spaces.
That's such an important point, because, you know, I do think that the coffee shop and the bar are going to be our frames of reference for what this could be. But I suspect that we're going to see a Gen 2.0 begin to evolve. So I think the first tier are going to look very much like either the European coffee shop model or look very much like your neighborhood bar. But what I'm curious to see as these begin to evolve is how the spaces evolve to reflect the different ways in which cannabis can be used. So, for example, you would never have a fitness-oriented space that's alcohol, where you're serving alcohol. It just those two just are incongruous. But you could certainly do that with cannabis. Create a space that aligns kind of fitness or wellness with cannabis, and have that be the consumption space, but perhaps that is focused on yoga or meditation. Or
I was going to say yoga seems great. Ideal.
Absolutely. I think that the idea of the religious experience, the connection of cannabis consumption and faith, lends itself to spiritual focus, spirituality focused spaces and consumption. So absolutely think that the tier one will be kind of the bar or coffee shop focused model. But I think where things start really getting creative is once you start building out the breadth of human experiences that intersect well with cannabis, and whether it's fitness, music, food, intimacy, religion, the options start to get really interesting about what you're bringing people to do and how they can amplify or elevate their experience that they might be doing in other spaces with cannabis in this particular forum. I think that's going to be an interesting thing to watch.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And oddly, we have a client here in Denver. I'm coming to you from Denver, Colorado, but they're the 420 Hotels, Inc. They're looking to expand, but for now, they have a beautiful historic boutique property here in Capitol Hill, Denver. They've cleared all of the regulatory hurdles for the cannabis part of being legal consumption space eventually, and now they're moving on to the construction and the build out. But their primary goal is to create, of course, that space, but that also that community, recognizing that sometimes people want to party and sometimes people will want to do yoga. And Chris Chiari, the owner over there, is very much building out a space that can be malleable for both and even whatever else is to come down to the pike in V2, V3.
Well, speaking on just your the experience, what are your thoughts on the BYOC gathering at the immersive Van Gogh exhibit, on the kind of those organized events?
We saw a lot of the BYOC model in the early adult use days in Colorado, so 13, 14 especially. Mm-hmm. And I think it's smart and pretty much necessary, especially because the existing regulatory infrastructure around sales is so rigid. I can't wait until we're about to see the rollout in this year, 2022, in the city and county of Denver, of on-site consumption spaces. And of course, we've been waiting for this for so long. So you will be able to buy your cannabis and then walk right into the consumption lounge and consume. And that's where we need to be. But until we get there, the BYOC model, there's no problem with that. Of course, some of the venue owners don't like losing that control. They're not divvying out that substance to you like they are in bars and restaurants, where they can kind of control your experience and how you might affect the vibe of the restaurant or the safety of others around them. So I think that's ideal that we have on-site sales. But in the meantime, you look at how challenging it was to even offer curbside sales in Michigan, Illinois, Colorado at the beginning of the pandemic, primarily because you were moving that sale outside of a structure. And that was immensely challenging, but we need to be able to go further. And we all know that there's immense double standards at play here. We're allowing every other regulated adult use industry to do things in a different way. And we will eventually get there, especially when you just look at some of those basics, because we're still seeing nearly 80,000 Americans die every year from alcohol-related causes. And that number is still zero for cannabis. And that's, of course, according to the CDC. So the more we align these kinds of opportunities and restrictions and regulations with the reality of these substances that we're dealing with, whether it's tobacco or cannabis or alcohol, the more we will see that open up and we can get away from BYOC to on-site sales. And ideally we can do both.
Well, you brought up how, during the pandemic, how that changed things. And I do want to jump over to the Rolling Stones article that you wrote on how COVID-19 impacted cannabis culture and consumption spaces. So talk to us about, what do lingering pandemic fears mean for this new market segment? So talk to us a little bit about this article, because this is very timely.
Yeah, this was my last column for Rolling Stone. It ran last month. And the point that I just wanted to dive into was, you know, when you think about March of 2020, at that point, right as COVID was marching toward the US and becoming more of a significant concern, we were really starting to see some momentum in some of these newer emerging state markets, allowing consumption spaces and these lounges that we're discussing. And a lot of that momentum, of course, was crushed and very much postponed because of how this virus spreads virally, you know, and it makes sense. And I think that we do need to rethink the consumption lounge model slightly, especially because COVID's not going anywhere, even if we are entering this endemic phase. But that's what I wanted to kind of dive into in there. One of the things that really was so enlightening to me when I really got into cannabis, because I wasn't a cannabis consumer for very long before I got the cannabis reporter job at the Denver Post. And one of the things that has really engendered goodwill to me and others is that whole model of sharing is caring. And it is kind of, it really makes sense when you think about all the concerts you've been to and you've never met the guy standing next to you, and yet he is passing the joint your way. And I love that. And I think some of that sharing is caring has to be rethought given where we are and where we will probably be for a long time.
Yeah, John, you and I have talked about this. The whole puff, puff, give is not really an option anymore. What is your take on that?
Yeah, totally agree with Ricardo. You know, the part of what the pandemic has done in a weird way is almost de-socialized cannabis. So you find that, particularly amongst networks where you don't know the people particularly well, you can be a little more hesitant to be hitting a product that has been going around a room with 200 of your closest strangers. But I think there's two kind of opportunities there. One is just rethinking the product landscape. So, for example, say rather than buying one gram joint that goes around the room, buying 4 quarter gram joints and everybody gets their own. It still remains a social experience, but everybody's consuming the individual product versus it being a truly shared kind of drinking from the same cup type of experience. Two, you're seeing a lot of innovation around say things like magnetic tips or removable tips. So you're still passing the joint around, but everybody's smoking from the same mouthpiece, kind of like you might do in a hookah lounge. These kind of products might have been eschewed as, you don't like me, you think I've got cooties pre-pandemic, but I think you're seeing them fly off the shelves now because people do want to maintain that social experience, but are a little more sensitive about drinking from the same chalice. So it will be interesting to see how long the resistance or the hesitance to smoke out of somebody else's mouth, so to speak, will linger as we go through this next wave of the pandemic being endemic. But we think there's a lot of opportunity to create a middle ground, either in smaller package sizes, smaller product sizes, where everyone is consuming individually, but in the same setting, whether it's attachments or peripherals that allow people to drink from the same chalice, but without that risk of sharing mucus. And all of this is kind of innovation that's happening in real time. And candidly, we think consumers they're experimenting with this as we go along. We'll see over the next couple of years which path will become more dominant. You don't go a lot of alcohol environments where people are drinking from the same cup. People aren't passing around a can of Budweiser in a room. It remains to be seen whether cannabis will evolve to being a little more of a segregated experience, but in a shared environment, or whether there'll be a lot of kind of product innovation that allows for the shared product, for a continued shared product, without any of the health risk that might be associated with the highly contagious the disease.
It's so true, John. One of my friends has a hookah style device for one of her vaporizers that specifically works with concentrates. And it's amazing. She'll throw a quarter gram of live resin in there. And then this hookah device has, it's like an octopus. It has five poses. And yet, just like if you're at the hookah bar, you keep your thumb over it, and then when it's your turn, and it's such a joy, because I think cannabis, it has to be shared. It's such a delight to be shared. To your point, most people don't. Most people consume at home, absolutely, a result of prohibition and lots of bad decisions. But when we hang out with that specific friend and have access to that, it's just such a treat, because otherwise we're kind of on different pages, you know? I have some edibles in my system and I'm hitting my vape pen, and you know, they might be combusting over there, and somebody else might have their Puffco Peak that they're kind of hoarding and keeping their germs to themselves. But here we're consuming all the same cannabis concentrate at the exact same time. And there's something special about that, just purely socially. I don't even know how to describe it or put it in words, but when you are experiencing the same exact substance and consumption methodology as everybody around you, it brings a certain same level that is difficult to accomplish, because so many of us have different consumption patterns and choices, preferences.
That's so true. Well, what do you think that the next thing that's going to happen for these consumption lounges, or what are your predictions for 2022?
Oh, well, you know, I see where we're going in Colorado, certainly. You know, having that on-site retail aspect is going to be really transformative. Of course, they have that in San Francisco, and that pilot program, from what I can tell, has been immensely successful. And I point to it regularly when I'm talking to regulators or law enforcement who are trying to poo-poo on this and say it's a bad idea. But I think they've shown really tremendous leadership. But then I would also look to what happened in Toronto years ago. I was lucky enough to meet a guy named Damien. He was a journalist with Vice, but he was also the front man of a great punk band that I love. The punk band, excuse my language, it's called Fucked Up. Great punk band, by the way. But I showed him around Denver when he was here, and he showed me around Toronto when I was there. It took me to 5 or 6 consumption lounges. And one trend that I saw there that I loved is that each one had its own niche. We started out because we were hungry at a consumption lounge that was known for grilled cheese sandwiches. I think they had like 15 grilled cheese sandwiches on the menu. That's all they sold, grilled cheese and chips. You took it upstairs, you did your thing. The next one we went to, since we had a nice buzz and a full belly, we went to a place that had comedy shows and rock shows there. And that was really wonderful. It was built around a stage. It was a great vibe, very much like a rock club. Well, it was a rock club. I think we're just tested or trained to not think of these things in traditional circumstances. And each one that we went to just had a completely different vibe and aesthetic and audience that they catered to. And I just found that really special. And I think, of course, we're going to see that more and more, especially as we move to that 2.0 phase that John mentioned earlier, because it doesn't have to only be a nighttime kind of thing. It can be, hey, let's go grab brunch, or let's go grab yoga and then brunch. And, you know, you're going to the consumption space, you know, at 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning, which I think is vastly necessary.
Yeah, that sounds like heaven. What are the, just out of curiosity, you were saying you were talking to law enforcement and regulators about why they said the on-site sales, they don't want it. What are their reasons for why they think it's a bad idea?
It's all fear, Heather. I mean, it's the same thing about delivery. It's the same thing about so many aspects of the cannabis industry, you know, including the foundational growing, processing, and retailing. But when you go outside of that to some of these secondary licenses like delivery and consumption spaces, it's just fear. I think especially law enforcement and regulators are concerned about what will happen when we open a consumption lounge and then people are going to have to get home somehow. You know, hey, well, those stoned people are going to be driving their cars home and you know, completely ignoring the fact that there's 15 bars within walking distance from that consumption space. So, of course, the double standard comes back, but we see the same thing with delivery in a lot of these emerging markets and a lot of the heritage markets. I mean, Colorado just got around to delivery in the last 6 months, primarily because of the stigma and the fear. I talked to a lot of law enforcement and regulators about that, specifically because they were really concerned about these delivery drivers carrying around all the cash and carrying around all the product. And that's why we really need these pilot programs, this leadership, you know, because in the same way that Colorado was that first of its kind adult use program, the first of its kind ever regulatory infrastructure for a recreational cannabis market. And we showed tremendous leadership there and passed that Colorado model to be implemented in different ways by other states and provinces. You know, the city of San Francisco has done a fantastic job with consumption lounges, and the state of California has done a really exemplary job of showing us how cannabis delivery can be a very normal functioning part of our ever increasing delivery economy. You know, again, if Drizzly can exist, then ease absolutely needs to exist.
Right. I feel like it's just kind of common sense when you say, like, getting home from a consumption place doesn't differ anything from getting home from a bar. It makes literally zero sense. And I think that you'd be a lot less of an aggressive driver after consuming.
I think it's actually one additional distinction, because we've had this conversation with like the DCPD, and most law enforcement will tell you, you know, 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. in most places where bars close at 2 is the worst time of night. You know, you've got people piled up in the streets. That's when you're most likely to have these kind of spontaneous conflagrations that happen. And anybody who's been on U Street or you know, been in DC at closing time just has seen these things happen. You're not going to have people spontaneously bursting into fights as they're walking out of a consumption lounge. I mean, just the social orientation, the physiological response of people's to cannabis is fundamentally different. And so we have become so accepting of some of these negative outcomes that come with an alcohol permissive society. We think it is normal that people will start fighting outside bars at 2 a.m. or hooting and hollering and causing all sorts of pandemonium. And these are quite likely things that you're not going to be seeing outside of social lounges. So we have always found it ironic that there's so much fear around this, but when you actually sit down and think through systematically how different a consumer on who's used cannabis versus somebody who's an alcohol might react and might behave, it's night and day, and the proof will be in the pudding. So to Ricardo's point, these test projects will, I think, likely demonstrate that the sky is not going to fall. And that's going to be really important in leading more jurisdictions, on both law enforcement and legislators, to realize that, you know, some of these fears are grossly overblown.
And it's also completely unrealistic, John, from the perspective of them assuming that everybody who leaves a cannabis consumption space is going to be so intoxicated that they cannot drive, because we know, right, I can go out and have a couple beers with dinner and be fine to drive home. And if I have more, then I shouldn't be driving home. And of course, it's the same exact thing with cannabis, but we have to get over the 80 years of misinformation. Because of course, all of us were brainwashed as children, unfortunately, you know, even if we had those progressive parents who told us, oh, okay, you know, don't worry about that whole just say no nonsense. You know, it was pervasive. It really was everything. When I gave my first TED talk years ago, it really was encouraging everybody in the audience and everybody watching that video to kind of push that control alt delete button inside your head, because chances are everything you learned about cannabis or weed or marijuana in your school and your formative environment was wrong. And so we don't have to continue demonizing this plant anymore. I think we've started to move beyond it. And at the same time, we know that this process of normalization is going to take a very long time, especially because of this patchwork state-by-state infrastructure that we have.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, I'm sure there'll be a lot more minivans parked outside of consumption places that people would not be expecting. There'll be some, you know, moms and dads going in there.
Heck yeah, carpool to the consumption lounge. Why not?
Exactly. well, thank you so much. This has been an amazing conversation. And we do offer our guests the ability to give a shout out to someone in the industry that you think is doing something great or inspiring. So I would love to give you that time to give a shout out to anybody you want.
Well, you know, I'm this is honestly off the top of my head, but because we are speaking about this subject matter, I want to give a shout out to a guy I know out in Las Vegas, because he is doing absolutely outstanding work at creating a very responsible and sensible infrastructure for consumption lounges. And it is Scott Rutledge who does just fantastic work for the cannabis industry and other industries out there. You know, Scott has worked with industry and with government in Clark County and Las Vegas City and Nevada State extensively to make sure that in the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, we can consume cannabis together. And we can be tourists and walk into an environment and buy cannabis and consume it, whatever type of cannabis that is. I've been fortunate enough to get to know Scott over the years and just have tremendous respect for him, not only as a human being, he's a great guy, but also he's just really passionate about this, and he has been for years. And we need more people in acting as that bridge between industry and advocacy and government and regulatory over here. And I think he's just done a really masterful job. And we already see some of the fruits of his efforts rolling out in Las Vegas over the last year. And I know he's not stopped. And I just had a call with him probably 2 months ago, and he's still on that train and still pushing for it. So Scott Rutledge out there in the LV, props, man, you're doing great work.
Awesome. Well, we need more Scots in the world, that means. Well, thank you both so much for your time. Thank you to our listeners for joining us at Canna Week. Again, please be sure to like, subscribe, and if you really like us, leave a 5-star review. I am your host, Heather Wickler, and we will see you next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.